top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 314 of the Really Awful Movies podcast. Extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile. Which has to take the cake for one of the longest movie titles ever, along with the incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed-up zombies, or the Roman Polanski effort, Fearless Vampire Killers, or Pardon Me, But Your Teeth Are in My Neck. It also has to count as one of the worst film titles of all time, maybe even superseding the terrible Hudsucker Proxy. It's just so eminently forgettable. Whether the movie is itself, I'm going to elucidate in this podcast here, but for the purposes of the discussion, I'm going to call it Extremely Wicked, even if I can remember that. So, yes, this is a biographical crime film about the devious, wicked, as the title says, and perverted escapades of one Ted Bundy. Some would call him charming, a failed law student whose crimes crossed four different jurisdictions and whose depredations continue to reverberate to this very day. The finger has been pointed at him for committing between 30 and 40 murders. Now, back to the title for a second. Extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile is revealed through the court proceedings when those were comments directed at the defendant by the presiding judge in Edward Cowart in the state of Florida. Which is kind of bizarre because it's something you'd probably at first glance associate as a catchphrase potentially with the serial killer if you were to guess. But it's not nearly that well known. It's not akin to, let's say, Die Piggy or Helter Skelter, or associated with the mass murderer Charles Manson, or the maybe Catch Me If You Can that was attributed in letters taunting Scotland Yard by the notorious Jack the Ripper. So it fails on that level, not to mention being long. It's kind of confusing from the get-go. Notably, this one stars Zac Efron as Theodore Robert Bundy. And kudos to him, although I can't say I'm a fan of his work or haven't had the opportunity to encounter much of it, but he's obviously a former child star, I believe High School Musical and that, and his desire and willingness to go against type here either reflects his star's prominence fading as he ages, or I'm sure he would like to say a willingness to try on different roles and to go against type and to really challenge himself professionally. And really, plaudits and kudos go to him for doing that, because this is the type of thing that sours me on the likes of more critically acclaimed actors such as Julie Roberts and Tom Hanks, who it seems, at least according to myself from a casual observer, that they don't seem to challenge themselves too greatly in any particular role, choosing to stay in their lanes, as it were, as in the case of Hanks, a lovable everyman, even if he's playing America's neighbor, Mr. Rogers, but Julia Roberts and her charming, put that in quotes, maybe, puppy dog, visage. But Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile came across my radar as I was going through some, I guess you would call them, serial killer dramas, and I'd recently not taken to what's often seen as the superior David Fincher, Robert Downey Jr. star, Zodiac. Although I'm a fan, if you want to call it that, not a fan, but I'm a devotee of some of the Zodiac, of the Zodiac case, shall we say, and follow it, and I'm more familiar with it than the particulars of the Ted Bundy case. Although it should be said also that Joe Berlinger also did, the director of this one, is also responsible for, I believe it's called Conversations with a Killer, so it's the Bundy tapes and has the infamous killer in his own words discussing his predation. Now, this is a fairly conventional film, and to the extent that it works or doesn't work, I think is reflected in that. Although the same, I think, could be said about Zodiac, which really fixates on the journalism aspect of it, and it's something I can appreciate as a journalist myself, but it doesn't exactly have deep currency or relevance or gravitas of, let's say, All the President's Men or something, but I definitely appreciated how the behind the scenes, how it was being reported on, because I think that's a more interesting conceit that Fincher chose versus the one selected for this one, which was to depict early family life of Ted Bundy and how he was a doting almost stepdad, I guess you can call him, to his first girlfriend in the Pacific Northwest, or one of his first serious girlfriends in the Pacific Northwest. And she's the character that really drives the narrative here. That would be his former girlfriend Liz, and her the unspooling of his acts and her unwillingness, it should be said, to really accept the fact that she was romantically involved with and in love with, I think it is safe to say, with one of the most brutal serial killers in modern day. So that's how the narrative unfolds at the beginning, and you sort of get a sense that Bundy is a family man, and they don't really show any of the violence perpetrated by Bundy. They only have the aftermath and the effects on his loved ones, immediate family, classmates, and Liz's co-workers. So this doesn't make for particularly engaging fare, although you gotta credit Efron for a very game effort as the Kennedy-esque killer, who also bears somewhat of a resemblance to Toronto's mayor, John Tory, which is kind of weird. I think it's definitely down to the hair. But in a 1 hour 50 minute runtime, the film doesn't really come alive until the back half, when the court proceedings depict just what really disclose what an awful, just reprehensible maniac monster that Bundy really was. So at the outset, you get again, the first half is primarily reactions to his behavior and subsequent denial of by his loved ones, and then also his two escapes from prison, which, for those who are unfamiliar with the Bundy specifics, is quite a shocking dropping of the ball by law enforcement. I would say far in excess of what officials might have missed from those suspicious Saudis who were getting flight instructions in Florida, you know, just before September 11th. But this one is just really a total bust. First off, Bundy is captured and charged with attempted kidnapping. Again, for those who don't know the Bundy case, his MO was to dress as an upstanding and charming, upstanding citizen, which was an attack he frequently took to get people's guard down, and then so he would frequently, I guess, use a prop that indicated he was injured, and then ask for help at the side of the road with a Volkswagen Bug that he would drive around. When a good Samaritan would stop by, seeing that he was injured and maybe not much of a threat as well because of his Kennedy-esque good looks, he would club them over the head with a crowbar and stuff them into the trunk and dispose of them. So that was the way he went about his evil deeds. And when he was one of his victims, I guess, was able to get away from him. I think this would have been in the state of Utah, which is where Bundy was a law student, and where he grew up primarily in the Seattle area. But he was a law student in Utah, and that's where he was first jailed and accused of attempted kidnapping. No further charges, I don't think. So I think he grabbed a woman, tried to put her into his car. His ability to escape from the law library is and slash courthouse, I guess you could say, is really really well depicted here. But it's just the director speculates that maybe the attending guard was busy trying to pick up and hit on one of the courtroom attendees. I don't know to what extent that's true, but regardless, I guess Bundy convinced guardsmen to let him go take a private phone call in the law library, and that's where actually he was given opportunity to study while he was being held, which was quite, I guess, speaks to the seriousness with which they treated attempted kidnapping, which strikes me as a serious, massively serious offense. But Bundy does leap from the third floor of the facility after testing himself and trying different ways to descend in his cell and jumping off his bunk and I guess strengthening his ankles, you could say, for the descent. And he succeeds to the extent that he's able to flee into the mountains, and then he's subsequently recaptured. Oh, my bad. It's actually Colorado. I was just thinking that, but I guess he was linked to other crimes in Colorado. But regardless, a mountainous setting, he was able to escape into them for, I guess, 6 or 7 days before being caught cold and hungry by the authorities and dragged in again. But it should be said he was not confined for long, because, again, his affinity for deviousness and his ability to escape, this is just really amazing. Again, for those of you who don't know, he was able to, cut a hole in the roof of his cell for one of the facilities he was housed in, and again managed to make his way to freedom. And this time, crossing the country even further away to Florida. So his, reign of terror crisscrosses the United States from the Pacific Northwest at a 45-degree angle, roughly, across to Tallahassee, Florida, when shortly after his arrival into the Sunshine State, a spate of murders took place around, forgive me if I don't have the details correct, but I guess it would have been around the Florida State, maybe. Maybe it was the Florida State campus, where a bunch of co-eds were murdered in their, sorority co-eds were murdered in their dorms, and he was subsequently captured and tied to the crime. Now again, the second half of this film is where things come alive, and you can see the care with which the filmmaker took to reproduce true elements of the story, including Bundy's dismissal or attempted dismissal of his legal counsel for not adequately representing him, a move which I don't believe he had the legal authority to do, but Bundy, as a law student, took to mounting his own defense and would try and time waste and deviate from the technical aspects of the proceedings by offering long-winded pronouncements about himself and filing ridiculous, frivolous motions regarding things like the food in the courtroom and what he was, and various other just very trivial matters in order to delay legal matters. These, of course, were found lacking, and with an overwhelming surfeit of evidence stacked up against him, including bite marks on the victims linked to his chipped teeth. It was curtains for Ted Bundy. Back to Zodiac, I guess, by comparison's sake, because again, we're going to pit the two serial killer dramas head to head a little bit. That one was way more procedural and way more narratively, if that's a word, interesting because of the heavy journalistic involvement versus just the familial, close romantic ties and the reactions and the court procedurals. It was more interesting to see a killer on the run than it was to focus on the killer himself, if that makes sense. So, well, again, Efron is game. The movie, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, suffers from, I don't know if suffers from is the right term, but the fact that the audience identifies in his character in a way, because he's so, charming and likable. And that's not really an effect you'd necessarily want to set up. And it doesn't really do much for the narrative. Whereas, I guess, yes, Fincher has the very well built up characters, including Robert Downey Jr. And their dealings with the Zodiac Killer were very similar, again, to the aforementioned Jack the Ripper, with taunting letters and ciphers that they had to also uncode or decode, I believe, in English, pardon me there, decode in order to get a better, more solid grasp on Zodiac's motivations, because he was frequently dealing with the press and giving, I want to say the San Francisco Chronicle, I hope that's right, exclusives, and trying to strong-arm the publication into devoting front-page coverage to it. Now, I guess this is the point of the podcast where I'm going to get to what I've learned here. Now, I learned this in the credits, but actually, James Hetfield, the singer in Metallica, plays a police officer in Utah who first arrests Ted Bundy. And the Four Horsemen, a popular track off the Kill 'Em All album, is featured in the film, which is weird because I didn't notice that one either. But another thing I noticed that John Malkovich, the outstanding actor from Being John Malkovich, was just such a superb, exemplary film. And you know, one of my favorites that has like a, I believe it's a 7.5 floor. Yeah, it's take it from me, it's a surrealistic masterpiece, and Malkovich is such a terrific actor, but he brings a lot of charm to the role of Justice Cowart, who has a kind of friendly, convivial rapport with Bundy, calling him, I believe, partner at times, and chiding him for being a little bit over his head as merely a law student who's really not, doesn't have the experience to be able to deal with a complicated capital murder case, and is in way over his head in order to be dealing with such things. Another thing I've learned is that Haley Joel Osment is in this thing. I mean, who would have thought that he plays the new boyfriend of Liz after she moves on from Ted Bundy, and he's barely recognizable to me. But again, it's been ages and ages and ages since he was in the M. Night Shyamalan thriller, The Sixth Sense. So he's got quite a unique, beady little almond-shaped eyes, and he's kind of the frumpy dump new beau for Liz after she takes a real 180 turn away from Ted. The Washington Post, I guess, as well, criticized the film for failing to distance itself from the glorification of Bundy and not addressing the impact of his crimes, but I think the film sufficiently does that, particularly with the evidence brought to bear in the court proceedings of the horrors that were inflicted upon the girls. Now, star rating, this is a tough one because, again, if you can only compare it to movies with which you're more familiar. So in my case, on the serial killer drama front, it would be Murder by Decree, the Christopher Plummer star that envisions a fictional world whereby Sherlock Holmes and the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle character investigates the true-life Jack the Ripper case alongside Watson. And that is, I think, probably the standout gem in this subgenre, unless you want to throw in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer into the mix, which in my mind is more on the horror film side of the ledger than a serial killer drama, broadly speaking. But if you were to be inclusive of that, I would say those are my top two serial killer dramas, if you want to call it that, with Henry inching out Murder by Decree although I've expressed my fondness for the latter on several occasions with Jeff, as it's one of the first horror films, again, the definitions here being so fluid, that I recall actually seeing. And I saw it at my grandmother's house in small town Ontario, and really in the middle of nowhere, on her big property in the middle of the woods. And I was I stayed up till about 1 a.m. to catch this on one of the local Toronto TV stations that would broadcast these kinds of more subversive, more violent, more sexually suggestive movies. So that was one that had a really early impact on me, and I think it holds up like stunningly to this day. Well, as does Henry, which, if people haven't seen it, it's just such a shockingly good movie, and an easy inclusion in my top 20 horror films of all time, or maybe top 25. I've been bandying about a list, and I was hoping to have that be podcast fodder for a future episode, but it's just so damn difficult without subdividing and further subdividing into categories different subgenres of this very fruitful and verdant genre. Like, as I said, there's no subcategories for particularly, I guess you could say some comedies are more raunchy while there others are more rom-com, but there's no subgenres of action or comedy or drama, even to the extent that there are for horror. I would have to, if I were to do a top 25, restrict my Italian lensed and directed movies to just two, so I wouldn't have those be overly representative in or overly weighted in my list, and that's practically impossible. I know the ones that would be the no-brainer inclusions, and that would be Hellraiser, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Halloween, and maybe The Shining. So that's four or five right there off the bat. You could throw in I'm particularly fond of opera over Suspiria, but again, so there's five movies that would be, oh, Maniac as well. So that's the no-brainer of the list for horrors. And then beyond that, I don't even know, like, as you get into 6 through 10, your Reanimators and your French New Wave, like Martyrs, and I have no idea how I would really be able to whittle it down without shortchanging some really exemplary work. It would be far easier to just subdivide things into, broadly speaking, supernatural categories, and then you could just have a list of top 10 dominated by the likes of A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Changeling, The Shining, and Hellraiser, and then you could exclude at least the serial killer type movies or the slash and stalk type movies, and that would make for a much easier list. But I will eventually get around to that, although hell, if you subdivided it further into sci-fi, you'd have Reanimator and Alien and Aliens and The Thing. It's just endless. Now for this one here, and I'm gonna have to pull up my my page here again, because I can't for the life of me recall what it's extremely wicked, vile, etc., etc., etc. This movie has all its quality disproportionately in the back end. So the beginning is just so pedestrian that you could have police close off the streets. I mean, it's just really, really paint by numbers, biopic-y. And even with the camera and visual aesthetic, it really has that Lifetime movie kind of look to it, and doesn't really have the darker elements that they could have well included, and that the very night focused outlook that that Zodiac has. So they could have really played that up a lot more, and at the same time conveying the just the sheer brutality of the antagonist. So that's a definite debit against it. Again, it's very performance driven, but this is not a horror movie, but I would liken it a little bit to Walk the Line, which again is very, very conventional and buoyed by terrific performances, but really doesn't tell you something you didn't already know about Johnny Cash. And in this case, similarly, all the beats are ones you'd expect. And a bugbear of mine, and a really something I find extremely annoying, is when movies, regardless of the genre, in the closing credits combine real life footage with the actors. I mean, the whole point is for actors to embody the in the case of biopics, people that they are playing. I mean, you don't have, it's just such a useless and pointless conceit. And with disaster movie, you see it and it's like, okay, we get it. The guy, you know, really plays Tommy Wiseau impeccably. Great, we get it. We saw that in the preceding 90 minutes. You don't need to put them side by side, in effect, comparing the real Tommy Wiseau with the actor who portrayed him. It's totally pointless, and with this effort here, big time strike against, here, I'm going to pull it up, extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile for including some of the real-life court footage and some of the footage of Bundy, going tête-à-tête with the media in scrums and showing that exact same scenes as depicted in the movie. It really detracts from it, and more detractions and debits come from the use of the very cliched period music. I mean, my God, the song The Letter, I guess popularized by Joe Cocker, and just, yes, it was the hippie era, although I guess kudos for not using Fortunate Son by CCR. I mean, my God. But still, I mean, some of the music, just very, very, very cliched. I think Lucky Man was thrown in there as well as an ironic, not even ironic, just an obvious soundtrack accompaniment to the role that serendipity and luck played in the Bundy case, as he was really able to prolong his misery by I guess two-thirds, I would say, because the authorities were not able to capture him despite very, very accurate police sketches, and also the fact that his MO was so well established, you know, going out to music festivals when he wasn't, you know, feigning gimp knees or what have you, or sprained ankles. He was going out to festivals and trying to hit on young women and trying to lure them into his vehicle. So anyway, this is another thing. But I'm going to, as I'm picking apart this movie toward the end, yeah, I'm saying the back half, 4 out of 5, really, really compelling. Front half, 1.5. I'm not even going to split the difference because there's too many debits even in the back half to really warrant wholehearted endorsement, but I'm going to give this, because we have a very useful 5-star measuring scale, I'm going to give this a tepid 3, but more accurately 2.75. And I look forward to chatting with you next week about other genre flicks and maybe diving into some more sci-fi and action, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.